Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
With the new mom celebrity translator. Simply enter the name as pronounced by your mother.
Kite Carbonaugh.
Then enter whatever vague information your mother knows about this person.
She's on TV and she's crazy.
And seconds later, you'll have the translation.
Oh, Kim Kardashian.
Well, as that skit from Saturday Night Live shows, translation isn't only a matter of what language you speak, but my next guest is an expert in that subject, having won many awards for his translations and as the director of the program in translation and intercultural communication at Princeton. And David Belos explains in his new book called Is That a Fish in Your Ear? Translation and the Meaning of Everything, that even in the age of Google Translate, there's more than meets the eye in trying to convey meaning between human beings. Welcome back to WNYC, David Belos.
Good morning.
You start the book with a discussion about times and history and places where there was no translation. If you were conquered by the Romans, you learned Latin. In India, everyone spoke multiple languages. And you talk about Christopher Columbus. This is the week of Columbus Day. How many languages did he operate in?
Well, we don't know for sure, and it's not certain that Columbus himself conceived of these things as different languages. He knew enough Hebrew to read astronomical tables, because we know he predicted a lunar eclipse based on tables that were only available in Hebrew at that stage. He obviously had Latin. He wrote the journal of his voyage in Latin, and then made a secret copy of it in Greek. So he was an educated man. But in his daily life, when he read books, sometimes he wrote notes in the margins in Italian or an old form of Italian. When he wrote to his boss, the Royal House of Castile, obviously he wrote his letters in Castilian Spanish. But when he actually got to the New World and found all of this, he gave it typically Portuguese place names, like Cuba is a typically Portuguese name. And we also know that he had some knowledge, if not complete fluency, in a contact language called lingua franca, which was spoken by sailors of the Mediterranean between the different shores of the Mediterranean, because in his Italian and Spanish there are some words from lingua franca. So, I mean, you know, he was a learned man, but then he just sort of spoke language, as it were, Mediterranean languages, as far as he needed to do his job.
Are you saying that there wasn't even the distinction in the way we think of it today between some of those languages?
I think not. I think the medieval and late medieval approach to language was to regard, obviously, the classic, the learned languages as proper languages because they had grammars and you learned them at school. But the contemporary vernacular forms of speech, which were written down only to a certain extent and not for all purposes, weren't conceptualized as these strange, hard-edged objects that we now think of as each separate language. They flowed much more into and out of each other than we currently like to think.
So Christopher Columbus's context, let's flash forward almost 500 years. Simultaneous translation, as many people think of it today, as they do it at the United Nations, for example, which I think you say could be called extreme translation. I didn't realize until your book that it only got its start at the Nuremberg trials for the Nazis after World War II.
That's right. That was the first actual practical use of this new skill, the first it was the first major need for it, and it was the first time bits of technology that had existed for a little while already found their application. And it was a very scary event. I mean, the Nuremberg trials were obviously very scary in themselves, but many of the linguists who'd been helping the prosecution teams and so forth leading up to the trial refused to work in the simultaneous translation arrangement that was put on. They thought it wouldn't work. They thought it would break down. They thought it would be a complete mess. But it did just about work, and it ushered in a completely new era, as well as a new profession, I mean, a new skill that had no real precedent to it.
Listeners, any of you have a story of maybe translation gone awry, or have you been new to a city and a language? When did you really need a translator. And did you use one? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for David Belos from Princeton, author of Is That a Fish in Your Ear? Translation and the Meaning of Everything. What's the reference in the title?
The reference is to the Babel fish. It's a fantastical invention of Douglas Adams in what was originally a radio serial, but it became a TV serial and then a movie and then a sequel called The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
And it was a book first.
I think it was a radio serial before it was a book, actually. I think it's the book of the serial. But anyway, the Babel fish is this magical object which you stick in your ear and allows you to understand any of the forms of communication used by any creatures in the galaxy. So my question, is that a fish in your ear? The answer is no, it isn't a fish in your ear. It's a translator.
Have you worked with Google Translate? It goes beyond looking up the individual meanings of words. We have a comment from a listener on our website that says, as a foreign correspondent, I worked side by side with a native translator for some years. Google Translation is ironically more helpful in terms of speed and word judgment compared to this individual. But so little of what this translator accomplished involved straight word-to-word translation. Most of it was cultural, including getting interviews with subjects I would never reach as a foreigner. So the comparison between strengths and weaknesses of Google Translate and human beings.
Well, I can't really say because these are, each usage is very special. And I mean, I haven't met your corresponding translator either. But Google Translate is a significant development. It really is a change in the relationship between users and language services. And I'm delighted to see it helping so much communication. But what I do try to point out in my book is that Google Translate is a clever engineering solution that is, like all engineering solution, uses stuff that's already there and that it doesn't itself invent. And essentially, Google Translate, whatever else it does, it's basically an exploitation of the millions and millions of pages of written translation already up on the web that have been translated by human translators.
In other words, it doesn't just go word by word. It looks for existing contexts in print.
That's right. And it tries to match and uses a probabilistic method of computation to judge which is the most likely match. Now, that's fine and that's good and that's absolutely splendid and it does serve many purposes. But you cannot trust Google Translate into any language that you do not speak yourself completely. You have to be able to judge whether the output is plausible, likely, or complete rubbish.
We have some really interesting callers with translation stories, like Danny and Nyack. Danny, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. As I was telling, I'm a school psychologist.
Uh-huh.
And we once had a situation where we couldn't understand why the Chinese-American mother that we were trying to explain the results to couldn't understand her son's results until the town hired a translator and who spoke her native language, and we realized that there was no such thing as somewhat agree in her language, and all the Likert type scales that we were using just didn't translate to her native tongue.
Right. So agree, somewhat disagree. There was no somewhat agree.
The range of things that different human languages do is enormous. Everything can be said in any language, but you have to know how, because the ways in which different languages do it are extremely varied.
And you say in the book that, case in point, there isn't even a word for translate in Japanese?
There are many, many words for to translate in Japanese. It depends what kind of translating is involved as to which word you would use. But the general sort of single concept, translate, Well, it can. I'm not a Japanese specialist myself, so I rely on my friends and advisors. But of course, you can talk about translation in general Japanese, but you've got a huge palette of words to talk about its distinctions, which you simply haven't got in English.
Ruben in Freehold, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ruben.
Hi. Good morning, everyone. I am actually a criminal defense attorney, and it is very frustrating. I'm a native Spanish speaker, and most of my clients tend to be Hispanic. And the translation and just the difference in words and the real meaning behind them is can sometimes be very frustrating, because I'll go to the judge and tell him, well, that's not exactly what he said. You know, you may say hit or touch, and it may be very similar, but, you know, if you're from a different place in South America, it may mean something very different and can really affect, you know, the severity of what they're saying.
Yes. Ruben, thank you very much.
Yes, I think court translators do a very difficult and a very important job, and it deserves a great deal more respect than it usually gets.
What kinds of translations do you do yourself the most, and which do you find the most satisfying?
Oh, you shouldn't judge by me. I translate books. I translate rather interesting books. I translate books I like. I'm a very privileged guy. But that's a very special, small, little part of the whole field of translation, which is absolutely huge and covers almost every aspect of life you can think
of. How about the idea of a literal interpretation of the Bible, which gets discussed a lot in this country, when the Bible wasn't originally written in English? Are things lost in translation?
The Latin translation of the Bible was declared by the Vatican to be the original at a particular point in time. And, of course, it wasn't even translated into the languages of many Christian countries from Latin until very late on. I mean, the French didn't have a Bible in French until the 16th century. Huh. The France had been Christianized for nearly 1,000 years by then.
Joy in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hello, Joy.
Hi. I just wanted to call and say I love your show, but
thank you.
Specifically on translations, I'm a Korean adult adoptee, and oftentimes when we go to Korea and try to get translations when we meet our birth families, it isn't just the words that get translated, but the cultural context in which our particular stories are unique. I find that in America, we use a lot of emotive language, and when those words get translated to our birth families, there's something that usually gets amiss. And because we don't speak the native language, we really depend on translators to be able to not only be able to translate the words, but to actually do some fact searching and give us a cultural context in which our birth families had to relinquish us.
Yes, that's fascinating.
And that simultaneous translation of being able to not just translate the words, but also give us a cultural context in which our stories are so strongly based on, I feel is a very, very important skill, and not that many translators in Korea are able to do that.
Joy, thank you very much. We just have 10 seconds left for a brief reaction to her.
Absolutely. It's the words that get in the way in translating. You have to understand what it's about, and you have to rely on human beings, not on machines, to do that for you.
David Bellos, Bellos, is the director of the Program in Translation and Intercultural Communication at Princeton, and the author now of Is That a Fish in Your Ear? Translation and the Meaning of Everything. And he will be reading from his book tonight at 7 at McNally Jackson Bookstore. That's at 52 Prince Street near Lafayette in Lower Manhattan. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks for listening, everybody.